This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Michael Vay, Battle of the Ampere, by Richard Paul Evans. Read by Kirby Hayborn.
Prologue. The E.S. Ampere. 100 kilometers west of Naples and the Tyrrhenian Sea. Aboard the Elgin superyacht, Ampere.
"Is it as bad as first reported?"
Chairman Skema asked. His voice was even lower and more coarse than usual due to the bronchitis he was fighting. Living at sea was taking its toll.
"Worse, Mr. Chairman. The Peruvian Star Source plant has suffered a complete bowl meltdown. More than 70% of the country is without power. The Peruvian government has declared a national state of emergency, and they're mobilizing engineers to restart their coal and diesel operations from before. It will be months before they have restored even half their country's power."
Chairman Skema coughed.
"The press must be having a feast."
"That's an accurate assessment. All the major television networks have reported the story. It's made the front pages of the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today, the Beijing News, the International Herald, and the London Times. Unfortunately, the media coverage is having an effect. The governments of Taiwan and Zimbabwe are holding emergency discussions about the possibility of phasing out our plants. And three countries have put Star Source plant production on hold. Brazil has completely cut off negotiations with us."
Skema dabbed his feverish forehead with a handkerchief.
"This is disastrous. Were the rats contained?"
"The ER were contained only because they were completely exterminated. More than 1.5 million rats were killed in the bowl's meltdown."
Skema erupted in another bout of coughing.
"Have we determined the cause of the meltdown?"
"The plant was attacked by a terrorist group."
"A terrorist group? The Shining Path?"
"No. A group called the Electro Clan."
"Michael Vay,"
Skema growled.
"He's just a kid."
"Then he's a very powerful kid."
"He's one of our own!"
Skema shouted.
"This is like Frankenstein. The monster has turned on its creator." "So that was Vay's plan? To destroy our plant and stop our global expansion?"
"No. According to our sources, Mr. Vay's mother was being held captive in the Peruvian compound. His only objective was to free her. Dr. Hatch apprehended him, but then Vay's fellow terrorists attacked the compound to free him. The power plant was collateral damage."
"You're telling me that we lost billions of dollars as a side effect of a boy looking for his mother?"
"Yes, sir."
"Was Mrs. Vay at the compound?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then Hatch never released Vay's mother as he was directed."
"It would appear not."
The chairman screamed out a long string of profanities, which ended in an equally lengthy fit of coughing.
"This is Hatch's doing! The man's gone rogue. Has he done anything we told him to? Have the rest of the electric children been released?"
"We don't believe so."
"Where was Hatch when all this happened?"
"He was at the compound."
"And where is he now?"
"He is on his way here, as per your summons."
"When will he arrive?"
"In about 3 hours.
"Alert security. Tell them to prepare the brig. They'll soon be accommodating a new prisoner."
"Yes, sir."
"Does Hatch have any of the electric children with him?"
"We don't know, sir."
"Then find out!"
Skema shouted.
"Under no circumstances are you to allow those children aboard this boat. Do you understand?"
"Yes, sir." "What do we do if they're with him?"
"Turn the helicopter away."
"If they won't go?"
"Then blow them out of the air."
With the youth aboard?
Yes, with the youth aboard! Are you an idiot? Do you have any idea how powerful those children are? They could take over the ship. Under no circumstance do we allow those children on this ship.
And kill Hatch as well?
Did you think we were going to let him live? He knows everything. Hatch will never leave this ship alive.
Part 1 Chapter 1 A Bad Dream. I'm Michael Vay. Last night, I had a really weird dream. I was back home in Idaho, sitting at the table with the cool kids in the cafeteria at Meridian High School. For the record, I'm not one of the cool kids. My girlfriend Taylor, who is one of the cool kids, was sitting on my right side in her cheerleading outfit. My best friend Austin was on my left, eating cheese pizza and garlic bread. The rest of the table was filled with a bunch of cheerleaders and basketball players. As usual, Austin and I looked as out of place as chocolate donuts at a Weight Watchers meeting. The school's basketball team was joking with me like they did at Maddie's party, calling me Lil Norris, short for Little Chuck Norris, and trying to outdo one another with their Lil Norris jokes. Drew, the basketball team's star point guard, said, "Lil Norris is so tough, Dark is afraid of him." "Yeah," said Spencer. "Lil Norris is so tough that the road in front of Meridian High used to be called Lil Norris Street, but it was changed because no one crosses Lil Norris and lives." Everyone laughed except Austin, who looked confused. "I don't think it was ever really called Lil Norris Street," he said. "Shh," I said, "it's a joke."
"Yeah?" said Drew. "Monsters check under their beds to make sure Lil Norris isn't there."
I got it, Spencer said. "Lil Norris is so tough that he died 10 years ago, but death is too afraid to tell him."
Everyone was laughing when a low, angry voice behind me said,
"If Lil Norris is so tough, why is he hiding in the jungle?"
I turned around to see Dr. Hatch standing behind me. I was paralyzed with fear. Suddenly everyone else vanished, and it was just the two of us. Hatch leaned forward, close enough that I could feel his breath and see his eyes through the dark lenses of his sunglasses.
"I'm going to find you, Vay,"
he whispered.
"And when I do, I'm going to hurt you."
That's when I woke up in the jungle.
Chapter 2 Number 15 It took me a moment to remember where I was. Some kind of Amazonian jungle insect beast was crawling on my face, and as soon as I realized it, I sat up, wildly brushing it off. Someone started laughing. A young native girl was on her knees on the ground next to me. She was wearing a dress made of tree bark and was holding something that looked like one of the dream catchers my mother used to hang on her wall. I also noticed that my foot had been packed in dark, dried mud, wrapped in leaves, and tied up with jute twine. Surprisingly, my ankle wasn't aching anymore.
"Hey," I said to the girl.
She gazed at me with dark, intense eyes.
"Jiao hen, hen kiai."
"I have no idea what you're saying," I said. "I have no idea what any of you have been saying."
She smiled, then set down the dream catcher and ran out of my hut.
Now what?
I thought. I lay there for a while, wondering what I should do. I still didn't know what the tribe had planned for me. It crossed my mind that I should try to escape, but where would I go? The jungle had to be at least as dangerous as this place,
and I'd only get more lost, if that were possible. Out of nervousness, I sat up and started making lightning balls and throwing them against the wall, which wasn't exactly smart. You know how they say that people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones? They could also say people in thatch huts shouldn't throw lightning balls, because the wall will catch on fire. It did. I had to use my shirt to beat the flames out. I had just extinguished them and was sitting back on my mat, pulling my shirt on, when the chief walked into my hut, flanked by two warrior tribesmen. There was still a lot of smoke in the room, and the chief looked at the burned spots on the wall, then back at me. As usual, the warriors just stared at me with angry expressions, like they wanted to skewer me with their spears, then eat me. "Good afternoon, Michael Vey," the chief said.
Hi, I replied, not sure how I was supposed to talk to a tribal chief.
My eye started twitching. I still didn't know how the guy knew my name. Just the fact that he spoke English freaked me out a little.
"How is your ankle?" he asked.
"It's not hurting like it was."
"Stand," he said.
I slowly stood. My ankle was still a little sore, but it was not nearly as painful as it had been the day before.
"It feels better," I said. He nodded. "The jungle medicine is strong. By tonight, it will be healed."
I didn't know what medicine they had used, or even when they had wrapped my ankle. I had slept through it all. But whatever they'd done was nothing short of miraculous.
"Thank you," I said.
He stepped closer to me.
"How did you dream?"
"I had weird dreams." He looked concerned.
"What did you dream?"
"I dreamt about this guy called Dr. Hatch. He said he would find me."
The chief frowned. "Then he will find you."
His saying that chilled me. Hatch had found me twice before, and both times I had barely escaped with my life. I couldn't imagine being lucky three times. "It was just a nightmare," I said.
The chief just looked at me gravely. "Wo si wang zhe yang," he said.
Then he said in English,
"We can hope."
"Do you know where my friends are?" I asked.
"The woman with the two boys is deep in the jungle. They are safe."
"What about the others? The ones like me?"
"They are not safe. The Peruvian army is hunting them, as they are hunting you. You must leave the jungle soon."
"Why is the Peruvian army hunting us?"
"I do not know their ways."
After a moment, he said,
"Come. There is someone you must meet."
"Who?"
"You will see."
The chief turned and walked out of my hut. The warriors stood next to me.
"Chan Chi Lai!"
one shouted. I followed the guards outside. We walked maybe 20 yards to the edge of the clearing where there was a small hut set apart from the others. We stopped at its door. The chief said to me,
"When you go, there is someone you must take with you."
He turned back toward the hut and raised his hands.
"Hung Fa!"
he shouted.
"Guo Lai!"
A moment later, a young woman came out of the hut. She looked like she was my age, pretty, with dark red hair and freckles. She looked at me curiously, then at the chief, as if awaiting an explanation.
"She is one of you," the chief said.
"She's American?" I asked. The girl stepped toward me. "He means I'm electric, like you. You must be Michael." I looked at her quizzically.
"How did you know that?"
because I know all the electric kids except for the last two the Elgin hadn't found. You're not a girl, so you must be Michael Vay. She reached out her hand. I'm Tesla. As my hand neared her, electricity began to spark between my fingers. I pulled back, afraid to shock her. I'm sorry, I said. I'm not trying to do that. She just gazed into my eyes. It's all right. You can't hurt me. I still kept my hand to myself.
Are you sure?
I'm sure, she said.
What's your power?
Have you met any of the others like us?
Yes.
Have you met Nichelle?
I stepped back from her. Yes.
Don't worry. I'm not like her. Actually, I'm the opposite of Nichelle.
You mean you're not a psycho-goth freak? She grinned.
I meant my powers. I don't suck away electric powers. I enhance them. Here, shake my hand.
She stuck out her hand again.
Go on.
I just looked at her.
Come on, she said. You won't hurt me. Promise.
I hesitantly reached my hand out. The closer I got to her, the more intensely my electricity sparked. When we touched, my hand was glowing pure blue-white, almost like it was in the rat bowl.
You have a lot of electricity, she said. It tickles.
Tickles?
Yeah, I usually don't even feel it.
She stepped back from me, and my electricity lessened.
You're very electric. Far more than any of the other glows.
You were amplifying my electricity?
Yes, but I wasn't really trying. If I tried, I could make you produce 10 times that, at least.
That could be useful, I said.
Dr. Hatch thought so.
My heart froze at the mention of him. You're with Hatch?
Not anymore.
Why are you here, in the jungle?
The Amakara rescued me. I escaped from the Star Source compound by crawling out through a pipe that runs underground.
The Weekend Express, I said. She looked surprised.
You know about that?
It's the same way I got out.
Then you know it just drops you out in the middle of the jungle with a lot of snakes and stuff. It was dangerous, being alone in the jungle. I'm not like you. I don't have any powers of my own. I probably would have been eaten by something if it wasn't for the Amakara.
Why were you here in Peru in the first place?
Hatch was using me to amplify the electricity the plant was producing. Do you know how the plant works?
The electric rats. She nodded.
I was able to increase the amount of electricity they produced by more than 3 times.
She cocked her head.
So you also know about the rat bowl?
I broke it.
What?
Actually, my friends broke it. I just helped. She looked at me in amazement. What kind of name is Tesla?
Actually, it used to be Tessa. A few months after I was captured by the Elgin, Hatch added the L, in honor of Nikola Tesla, the great inventor and pioneer of electricity. He's the guy who invented the Tesla coil.
Like in science, I said.
She nodded. Hatch thought changing my name was pretty clever. Tesla is also the name of one of the Elgin boats.
They have boats?
Practically a whole navy.
Why?
It's where they live. If they lived in any real country, they'd probably be arrested. So they made their own country.
You've seen their ships?
Only the Ampere and the Volta. The Volta is a science boat. It's where they do their most secret experiments. It's not as nice as the Ampere. The Ampere is where all the Elgin brass are.
Brass?
You know, the bosses. Hatch's boss.
I didn't know he had a boss.
Tesla grinned.
I don't think he does either. I'm pretty sure they don't like each other. Hatch calls them the Board of Jesters.
You should change your name back. Tess is a pretty name.
She thought about it for a moment.
I like that idea. It could be my Declaration of Independence.
She nodded.
Call me Tessa.
Tessa, I said.
So, how long have you been here?
I've been in Peru for more than 2 years. I came 3 weeks before they turned on the Star Source plant, but I've been in the jungle about 6 months, I think. It's hard to keep track of time out here. It's not like the Amakara have calendars.
You've been here for 6 months, and the Elgen still haven't found you?
They sent guards out looking for me.
Tessa looked at the chief.
But the Amakara know the jungle. They protect me.
I am sorry we cannot protect you now, the chief interjected.
I had forgotten that he was even standing there.
There are too many of them coming. The dark magic of the Chulalongkorn key is too strong for us.
Tessa turned to me.
Do you know what's going on out there?
When we shut down their power plant, all the guards came after us. But now the Peruvian army is looking for us too. The chief said we'll have to leave their village soon.
Hearing this upset Tessa, and she began to tear up.
Then we'll leave, she said to the chief. You've risked too much for me already.
The chief frowned.
It is with great sadness that you leave, he said. You are Amakara, Hongfa.
He turned and walked away. I let Tessa compose herself before I asked,
What's a Chulalongkorn key? The natives believe the Chulalongkorn key is a demon who lives in the Amazon jungle. It appears as a friend and lures people off into the jungle where they are never heard from again. The chief thinks Hatch is the Chulalongkorn key.
He's right, I said.
Tessa nodded, then said,
I have a lot of questions. Do you want to go into my hut and talk?
Sure, I said.
I followed her inside. Her hut was nicer than the one I'd stayed in. The walls were decorated with bright red and green parrot feathers, and the ground was completely covered with a thick mat woven from leaves. We sat cross-legged across from each other, my back toward the door.
Nice place, I said.
She grinned.
For a jungle hut.
She looked at my mud cast.
What happened to your foot?
I hurt it while I was escaping from the Star Source plant. I woke up this morning with this mud pack on.
Is it broken?
I don't know. I'm hoping it's just sprained.
The medicine they put on it will help, she said. Your face keeps twitching. Are you okay?
I have Tourette syndrome, I said. It makes me blink and gulp, stuff like that, especially when I'm under stress.
Tourette's, she said. I've heard of that. Is it contagious?
No, it's genetic, I said. You won't catch it.
She nodded. Before I came to Peru, there were two of you that the Elgin couldn't find. You and a girl. Did they ever find her?
Taylor, I said.
Then you know her?
I nodded. I know her. She looked at me for a moment, then said,
You like her.
Why do you say that?
I can tell by the way you said her name.
I didn't realize I was that obvious. She's my girlfriend.
Where is she?
She's out in the jungle with the rest of the Electro Clan.
What's an Electro Clan?
That's what we call ourselves. They're my friends. Some of them used to be with Hatch. You might know them. Ian, Abigail, and McKenna.
Zeus.
Her eyes narrowed.
Zeus? You're with Zeus?
You know Zeus?
I know them all, she said.
I knew Zeus the best, since Ian, Abigail, and McKenna were locked up for insubordination. I'm glad Dr. Hatch finally let them out.
He didn't. We rescued them.
And Zeus?
He came with us.
That surprises me, she said. But he always was a wild card.
He still is.
So, how did you meet up with them? She asked.
It started when Hatch kidnapped my mother and Taylor. I went after them.
Have you ever met Dr. Hatch? I mean, face to face?
I nodded. The last time I saw him, he tried to feed me to his rats. She grimaced.
Hatch made me watch someone be fed to the rats. That's what he does to the guards who disobey him. How did you escape?
I absorbed the rats' electricity. It made me too electric for them to touch.
You can absorb electricity?
That's how I stopped Nichelle.
She looked surprised. You stopped Nichelle?
Yes.
No one's ever stopped Nichelle.
Suddenly, Tessa looked up.
Ni Yao Shema?
I turned. The young woman who'd been in my hut when I woke up was standing in the doorway looking at us.
Hang Fa, Tabe Laili, Tade Jiao Hai Huade, Wo Su Bang Ta.
How, how, Tessa said. She looked at me. I guess you have to go.
Where?
She said your foot is still hurt. She needs to work on it some more.
I lifted myself up.
Yeah, it's still a little sore. It was nice meeting you.
Same here, she said. Though kind of surreal.
What do you mean?
You're kind of a legend. Like Bigfoot, or the Loch Ness Monster.
I looked at her quizzically.
It's just that everyone at the Academy has talked about you for years. But I never thought I'd ever really meet you. Especially not in the middle of the Amazon jungle.
I never thought I'd be in the Amazon jungle, I replied. Chapter 3 A Rushed Departure.
I followed the young woman back to my hut. When I got there, there were two stone bowls on the ground next to my bed. One had a thick green substance in it. The other one also held liquid, but it was dark and watery with purple flowers floating in it. There was also a pile of fresh leaves next to the bowls.
Zuo,
she said, pointing to the mat. I guessed she was telling me to sit, so I sat down. She knelt down, untied the jute twine, and peeled back the leaves around my ankle.
Feng Xia,
she said.
What?
She pushed back on my chest.
You want me to lie down? I asked.
I partially lay back.
Like this?
She laughed and pushed me again.
Feng Xia!
I lay back. She set the leaves aside, then began peeling the hard clay from my foot. When it was all off, she washed my foot with warm, sweet-smelling liquid, then began rubbing some kind of salve on it. She kneaded my foot for nearly an hour. The massage felt really good, and the concoction she was rubbing into my ankle made my skin tingle. I started to sit up to look, but she gently put her hand on my chest to stop me.
Qing Bu.
Sorry, I said, just looking. I lay back and closed my eyes. After my ankle was fully coated, she wrapped it in fragrant leaves, then gently tied it with the same cord as before. Then she came around and began running her fingers through my hair.
This is like... better than a day spa, I said, even though I'd never actually been to one, and she couldn't understand me anyway.
She didn't speak anymore, but continued to massage my scalp and gently tug on my hair. I had no idea what this had to do with healing my foot, but it felt really good. After a few minutes,
She began to sing.
Henke aida, bu si huang wo, tai ki shi, yin wo ani. Henke aide, wai guo hides, ho ni li wo, hui ni xiang wo. Wo si wang hui, yin wo ai ni, yin yu hides, hui xiang ni.
She sang the words over and over. I had no idea what she was singing, but it was pretty and soothing, and she seemed sad singing it. At one point, she got particularly emotional. I partially opened one eye and saw that she was crying. She was still singing when I fell asleep. I had another dream. I was alone in the jungle when a tiny Peruvian man with a wooden leg came to me.
"We must hurry to some place safe," he said. "He is coming."
"Who's coming?" I asked.
"El Chulanchaki."
"Who is that?"
"No time to explain," he said, running off into the jungle.
In spite of his size and wooden leg, he moved quickly as I ran after him, deeper and deeper into the trees. The farther into the jungle we went, the darker it got, until it was nearly dark as night. Finally, we stopped in a place that was too thick to hike through. The branches of the trees around me were snakes, snapping at me. I looked at the man fearfully.
"I thought you said you were taking me someplace safe."
"There is no safe place anymore."
"Who is El Chulanchaki?"
He looked at me and smiled.
"Me."
Then he disappeared. I woke, gasping. It was dark around me, and the hut was slightly illuminated by the glow of my skin. The girl was gone. I took a deep breath and rubbed my forehead. "I've got to stop dreaming," I thought. It was about a half hour later that the young woman returned. I could see her silhouette in the entranceway. She wore flowers in her black hair and dozens of red and purple beads, which shone against her bare shoulders and neck. She looked pretty.
"Henkaida nilaile."
She reached her hand out to me. I took a step toward her and realized that my foot felt completely better. I touched it, then looked at her and smiled. "Thank you."
"Bu yang xie."
She took my hand and led me out to the center of the village, where there was a large fire blazing. The natives looked at us as we arrived, their faces lit by the flickering flames. They were sitting around the fire on mats woven from palm leaves. There were many more women than men, and I guessed that the warriors were out patrolling the jungle. I sat down on a mat next to the young woman, who looked very happy, her face blanketed with a contented smile. "It's a pretty night," I said. She didn't speak. "I can't believe that you fixed my foot. Doctors in America can't fix a foot that fast." She looked over at me, her eyes gazing deeply into mine.
"Hey, Glow Boy, she doesn't speak English."
I turned around to see Tessa walking up to us. At her approach, the young woman frowned, then quietly stood and walked away. In the shadow outside of the fire, I could see Tessa's faint glow, which was comforting to me. My own glow increased as she got nearer. She sat down next to me.
"What's going on here?" I asked. "It's a funeral dinner. That's why the women are wearing those red and purple beads."
"A funeral dinner? Who died?" Tessa gave me a funny smile.
"We did."
I stared at her. "They're going to kill us?" She laughed.
"No, Glowworm. When someone leaves that they won't see again, they consider them dead."
"That's creepy."
"It's their custom,
I mean, it's not like Americans don't have weird customs, like carving faces into pumpkins and putting candles in them, or hanging lights on Christmas trees. How weird is that? I never thought about it that way. That's because it's what you're raised with. Same with them. Unfortunately, their customs won't be around much longer.
Why is that?
The Amakara are going extinct, she said. There used to be thousands of them. Now, this is all that's left. There are more old people than young. Soon they will be down to less than a dozen people.
Why are they going extinct?
Same reason the American Indians did, she said. Disease, the shrinking forest, the modern world.
The young woman returned and handed me a stone bowl filled with a yellow substance, mashed like potatoes.
Woge nietje, kiaide.
I didn't know what she said, but thanked her. She left us again.
Tessa asked, Do you like mihua?
I looked down at my bowl. I don't know. I've never tried it.
Tessa burst out laughing. No, mihua is the girl who's been taking care of you.
I looked up at her. Oh, sorry. She seems nice. She mostly just looks at me and laughs.
Tessa grinned. Of course. She's only 12. And she thinks you're cute.
How do you know that?
Because she calls you Henkiai.
I looked at her blankly. Yeah, I've heard that. What does it mean?
It means she thinks you're cute.
I wasn't sure what to say to that. She's cute, too.
Tessa smiled. If we were sticking around, the chief would probably marry her to you.
She's only 12.
The Amakara marry young.
Then it's a good thing I'm not sticking around, I said.
Good thing, Tessa repeated.
I changed the subject. So, what's in the bowl?
Mashed bananas, she said.
Bananas, I said. Then it's good for our electricity.
Yes, but I don't think the Amakara know that. It's just what they eat.
I picked out a piece of something white and fibrous from the fruit. This isn't banana. She took the piece from me and put it in her mouth.
It's piranha.
Piranha?
Yeah.
What does it taste like? She looked at me with a wry smile.
Chicken, of course. Just be glad it's not the Yasye gump.
What's that?
Squashed termite larva.
They eat that?
Sometimes, Tessa said. It takes some getting used to.
I don't think I'd ever get used to it.
You'd be surprised at what you can get used to, Tessa said.
Do they eat much piranha?
Yes, maybe because it's so easy to catch. The river is full of them.
What do they use for bait?
The Amakara use spears to fish, so there's no bait. But I've seen the Peruvian jungle men fish, and they use just about anything. I once saw a man cut a callus from his foot, put it on a hook, and fish with it.
My dinner was looking less appetizing by the second. We're eating foot fungus-fed piranha.
I told you the Amakara use spears. Go on, don't be a chicken. It's good. Besides, eating piranha is a lot better than the other way around.
Just then, an older woman with gray hair walked up to us.
I could tell that Tessa liked her by the way her face lit up when she saw her.
The woman held out a bowl of food to Tessa. Tessa took the bowl, then said,
Siai siai, muchin.
The woman smiled.
Buyong kechi,
she said. She touched Tessa on the cheek, then walked away. How did you learn the language?
I only know a little. If you hang out long enough, you start picking up things. Like, this is how they eat.
She held up her hand with three fingers together.
You hold your fingers like this, and scoop it up.
She lifted a lump of the stuff to her mouth and ate it. I imitated her, dipping my fingers into the pasty goo, then put it into my mouth. Honestly, it wasn't that bad. I would never think of eating fruit and fish together, but in a jungle sort of way, it worked. We ate a moment in silence. Then I asked Tessa, "So, what are you going to do after we get back to America?"
"I don't know. I guess I'll just try to live a normal life, whatever that is."
"You could, like, work for an electric company. Or with scientists." She raised an eyebrow.
"I could if I wanted the Elgin to find me."
"Sorry, bad idea," I said. "Do you think Hatch will ever stop looking for you?" She frowned.
"No. Hatch never gives up. And he never forgets. It's something he's proud of."
She slowly exhaled.
"What about you? What are you going to do?"
"I'll go home with my mom, finish high school."
"That sounds nice," she said. "Home."
She looked at me, then asked,
"Do you think Hatch will leave you alone?"
"No." After a moment, I asked, "How did Hatch get you?"
"I was 9. They kidnapped me from my room."
"That's horrible." She looked down.
"It was pretty traumatic. But the Elgin psychologists, they..."
She paused.
"Help you forget."
"So, you don't remember your family?" Her expression fell.
"I remember some. I had a little brother, and my mother was just about to have another baby. He'd almost be 6 by now."
"You could find them."
"No. I can't go back," she said.
"Why not?"
"It's not my world anymore."
"It could be." Her expression grew more sorrowful.
"No. I've seen too much."
She slowly shook her head.
"I've done too much. I don't belong anymore. They wouldn't want me."
"Of course they would. I bet they think about you all the time." Her eyes looked pained.
"No. It just wouldn't work anymore."
"Why are you saying that?" Her eyes flashed.
"Because it's true. When the Elgin take you, they do things to you. They change you. You're not the same person you were. They convince you that your family doesn't really want you anymore. They make you angry at them. They get you to denounce them."
Hearing this made me heartsick. "Did you denounce your family?" She didn't answer, but I could guess the answer from the pain in her eyes.
"You know that Hatch and the Elgin are liars, right?" "Logically, I do. But this stuff is programmed into you as a kid. It takes root and grows into who you are. Pretty soon, you can't pull it out anymore because it's all that's left of you. Even if you know it's not true, it's all you know."
Her voice fell.
"It still feels true. And deep down inside, you're afraid that they're right."
"They're not right," I said. "The Elgin can twist the truth all they want, but they can't change it. A million lies can't make a single truth."
"But they can bury it so deep you'll never find it," she said.
She took a deep breath.
"Can we talk about something else?"
"I'm sorry," I said. Just then, an Amakara tribesman ran into camp. He was speaking excitedly, and his hands flew wildly around him as if he were swatting at a swarm of bees. Everyone around us stilled, and the chief's expression grew solemn. Then he stood and walked over to us.
"The army is near. It is time for you to go to the river. Mashang."
"Now?" I asked Tessa.
Mashang means immediately,
Tessa said, setting her bowl down on the ground. The chief shouted something, and a woman ran away from the fire, then returned carrying two woven blankets.
You must wear these, he said, to hide your glow.
We put them around us, like cloaks, so that only our faces showed. A half-dozen warriors surrounded us.
Come, the chief said. We must hurry.
I looked across the fire. Mei Hua was looking at me. A tear, glistening from the light of the fire, ran down her cheek. I waved at her, but she just turned away. The expedition was composed of Tessa and me, the chief, six warriors, and the old woman who had served Tessa food. The Amakara village wasn't far from the river, less than a half hour by foot, and we hurried through the jungle as fast as we could run, over fallen trees and around quicksand, with hardly a wasted step. Everyone moved quickly, even the elderly woman, who I had trouble keeping up with. Every now and then the chief would turn back and say to me,
Quai! Quai ba!
Which I took to mean, run faster. We moved without speaking, and a few times we heard the echo of gunfire in the distance, which only increased our pace. I wondered if the army had reached the Amakara village, and if they would harm the villagers. At the river, we walked down a small incline to a dugout canoe. Two caimans were on the shore next to the canoe, but turned and splashed into the water at our approach, their thick tails making final flicks at us before disappearing in the dark brown water. Two of the warriors got into the canoe, while the others began cutting large fronds from the trees that overhung the bank, piling them next to the canoe.
Get in,
the chief said to us. Tessa turned to the old woman. There were tears in both their eyes.
Muchin,
Tessa said, and they embraced. The tension around us was thick, and in spite of their emotion, they held each other for only a moment before they separated. The woman took off one of her necklaces, a long string of bright red seeds, and put it over Tessa's neck. I now understood that the old woman had come with us only to say goodbye.
Quai ba!
The chief shouted.
Meo Xie Jian!
The pair embraced once more, then Tessa turned and climbed into the boat. She turned back one more time to look at the woman.
I will never forget you, Mama, she said.
The old woman touched her hand to her heart. I climbed into the boat after Tessa.
Michael Vey, the chief said. Look at me.
Yes, sir.
I have dreamed a dream. Over the water, a choice will come to you. You must choose between the lives of a few you love or the lives of many you do not know.
I don't want that choice, I said.
No one would wish that choice, but fate does not bend for us. We must bend to it.
Now go! Chuba!
The tribesmen motioned for Tessa and me to lie down next to each other. Then they pulled our blankets up over us and covered us with the broad green leaves they had collected. The floor of the canoe was rough and pungent and looked as if it had been pounded out with rocks. Beneath the blankets, our glows were bright enough to easily see each other. The boat was narrow, so our bodies were pressed tightly together. My glow was brighter wherever her body touched mine. I was anxious, and my electricity arced loudly between us.
Can you stop doing that?
Tessa whispered.
I'll try.
With some effort, I made the arcing stop, though an occasional build-up would jump between us, especially from our heads, which were touching.
It's so cramped, she said.
She pulled the necklace she'd just received up around her throat, then slid forward until my head was against her chest.
Is this better? That's better, I said. I could hear her heart pounding rapidly. Lying against her like this made me think of Taylor. I remembered how she'd held me that night by the pool outside of Mitchell's house. I wished she were with me now. Actually, I wished we were back at Mitchell's house. The tribesmen pushed the boat away from the shore, and I could hear the rhythmic slap of their paddles against the water as we slipped out over the cold, dark river. "Who is that woman?" I asked Tessa.
"That's Aije," she said. "But I call her Muchin for mother. She's been like a mother to me since I was found."
Considering that she had been separated from her real mother at such a young age, I wondered what that meant to her. "That's a pretty necklace she gave to you," I said.
"It's made from huairuro seeds. It's supposed to bring good luck."
"We could use it," I said. I had no idea where we were going or how long we would be in the boat, but I gathered it might be a while. After a little while, Tessa fell asleep, but I couldn't sleep. At least, not at first. I was too worried. Not just about us, but about my mother and my friends. I lay awake for what seemed like a long time before sleep overtook me. Chapter 4 A Surprise Reunion. I awoke to one of the tribesmen shaking me. I rubbed my eyes and looked up. It was dawn, and Tessa was already sitting up, her hair matted to the side of her head. She pulled her hair back from her face.
"I think we're here."
I lifted myself up and peered over the side of the boat. We were docked, but all I could see was more jungle. "Where's here?"
"I don't know," Tessa said. "Somewhere downriver."
"With your old friend Jaime," a voice said.
I spun around. Standing behind us on the shore was Jaime, the Peruvian man who had brought us into the jungle.
"Jaime!"
"Mr. Michael," he said, stepping forward. "Let me help you out."
"Help her first," I said, looking at Tessa. Jaime offered her his hand, but she grabbed the side of the canoe and climbed out by herself. I got out too. When I was on the bank, he said,
"Congratulations, amigo."
I looked at him quizzically.
"What for?" "For still being alive," he said, "and for making some serious trouble. Mucho caos."
I'm pretty sure that that was the first time in my life that someone had congratulated me for causing trouble.
"More than we planned on," I said.
Tessa looked at Jaime suspiciously.
"How do you know this guy?"
"He's the one who brought us into the jungle."
"How did you meet him?"
"I'll tell you later," I said. "But we can trust him. He's a friend."
She still looked unsure.
"You're from Idaho. How do you have a Peruvian friend?"
She looked directly at Jaime.
"Are you an Elgin?"
"Uf, qué locura,"
Jaime said. He looked her directly in the eyes.
"Do not insult me. I would rather cut out my own heart and feed it to the piranhas than to be called one of those demons."
"That's pretty graphic," she said.
"We have not the time to chit-chat," Jaime said. "We must hurry. You have angered the Elgin wasps, and they are looking for someone to sting."
"Where are we going?"
I asked. "Into the jungle," he said.
He turned to the tribesmen.
"Fei Chang, Sai Sai."
They slightly bowed.
"Bukechi,"
they replied. They immediately paddled away from the shore until they were in the middle of the river and headed upstream.
"Those guys are strong," I said. "They didn't even rest."
Jaime turned back to me.
"They have not time to rest," Jaime said. "Neither do we. Come, vamonos!"
We followed him through a path in the trees that quickly disappeared, overgrown with foliage and snarled tree roots that rose like snakes through the jungle's dark soil. Even though it was morning, beneath the canopy, it was dark enough that Tessa and I could see our glows. We had hiked more than an hour into the jungle when the foliage in front of us suddenly lightened into a small clearing, exposing an elaborate campsite built next to a stream.
"We are home," Jaime said.
"It's not my home," Tessa said, looking around. I surveyed the camp with wonder. "How did you get all this stuff back here?"
"With much work," Jaime said. "This is our base to monitor the Elgin."
The camp consisted of two large nylon tents, a cooking spit, a generator next to at least a dozen plastic gas cans, and a metal communications tower that rose as high as the trees, but no higher. About 15 yards from the camp, Jaime suddenly stopped, holding his hands out.
"Alto."
In spite of my B+ and Mrs. Waller's 8th-grade Spanish, I didn't recognize Jaime's command to stop, and Tessa and I just kept walking.
"I'm starving," Tessa said. "I hope he's got something to eat."
Jaime lunged at me, grabbing me by the arm.
"Parate! Stop! Do not walk any farther!"
I hadn't seen him coming for me, and instinctively pulsed. Jaime screamed as he fell to the ground. I looked down at him. He was holding his arm and moaning.
"Ay, caramba! Caramba! Caramba!"
"I didn't mean to do that," I said. "It's just habit."
"You are worse than the anguila,"
Jaime said, still grimacing with pain.
"You must not walk any farther."
From the ground, Jaime pointed toward a twitching pile of fur lying near the second tent.
"See? It is a trap."
"Who would set a trap out here?" I asked.
"I did. It is a safety."
"A safety?" Tessa replied. "I think you're using that word wrong." Jaime rose to his knees. He picked up a fallen branch on the ground and threw it into the clearing 10 feet in front of us. There was an immediate eruption of gunfire and bullets that tore through the wood, shredding it into slivers.
"Whoa,"
I said.
"That totally could have been us," Tessa said. "Swiss cheese."
"That is my safety, to make sure no one enters my camp when I am gone. Before we go in, I must deactivate the sensor."
"I'm for that," Tessa said. Jaime took a small black cylindrical object out of his pocket. It was about the shape and size of a lipstick tube, with a single red button on top. He pushed it.
"It is safe now."
Looking at the quivering animal near the edge of the clearing, I wasn't about to step into the firing zone.
"Are you sure it's off?"
"Yes. Look."
He lifted another piece of wood and threw it into the clearing. This time, nothing happened.
"It is turned off."
He pointed toward the gun.
"There is no light on the turret."
He climbed back to his feet and stepped forward, still rubbing his shocked arm.
"We are safe. I will go first."
He walked into the clearing, with Tessa and me close behind. "That was pretty cool," I said. "How does it work?"
"It is simple, amigo. There are two guns."
He led me to one of the machines. The turret was run by electric motors mounted onto steel pipes that Jaime had wrapped up in leaves. The contraption looked simple enough, and my first thought was that Austin could probably build one of these from spare parts he had in his bedroom. The thought of that made me miss him.
"It is a robotic sentry that runs off a program from my laptop. I bought it from an American company that makes them for paintball guns."
I touched the gun's barrel. It was still warm. "They make these for paintball guns?"
"Yes. I just made some adjustments."
He pointed to the other side of the clearing.
The other one is over there behind that tree. They are very fast. Each one can move so quickly.